following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good evening, everybody. Can you hear me okay out there? Great. So it's been nice sitting with you this evening. Good to be together tonight. I see some names and faces I don't know so well, so special welcome to those of you who are new to Village Zendo. My name is Shinryu. And the tough times continue. It seems like we can't catch a break. It's one thing after another. So yesterday, we learned that no one was going to be held legally responsible for the killing of Breonna Taylor. On top of the presidential campaign, as if that weren't enough source of anxiety, we now have a battle that's going to unfold over the Supreme Court appointment. We've had wildfires in the West. We've had hurricanes in the South. The health crisis continues. The economic crisis continues. So it's a lot to take in, a lot to absorb. How are we practicing with all of this? I remember speaking a year or two ago about the mental health crisis affecting young people and students around the country. And I think about my own students in the university. And I recently came across a Twitter posting from a professor at pull it up here. Where are we? Yes, a professor at Hunter College who did a survey of her students. And she asked them, what are the things that they've lost during the pandemic? And you can imagine a lot of people talked about the loss of stability, the loss of security in their lives. But I thought I'd read you some of the answers. I thought they were striking. So these were some of the answers of things people had lost during the pandemic. The jobs of everyone in my house, a sense of security, a good night's rest, visiting my parents without being afraid to touch them, shame around the stigma of mental health. That's interesting. They said they had lost their shame around the stigma of mental health. A steady routine, my Metro card, the classroom, the freedom that came with living at the dorms, my grandfather, prompt election results, sense of time and routine, a night out, motivation, parties, dance floors, sleeping in my bed alone, sense of control over the future, stability, reality, freedom, intimacy, privacy, space, freedom, our dignity, hope in relief from our government, trust in news sources, post-college plans. Some people found a silver lining. One person said they'd street harassment was something that they'd lost. The need to put on a smile was something someone had lost. Bad spending habits, something they'd lost. Obliviousness, some apathy, people said they had lost. So it's a lot to be coping with, and I'm wondering how all of you are doing, how you're practicing under the circumstances. And I thought about a passage that from a book that I admire that I wanted to share with you. This is a book written by the great Trinidadian intellectual and activist and historian named C.L.R. James. C.L.R. James wrote a great book. For me, for my money, I'd say one of the greatest works of history in the 20th century. It's called The Black Jacobins, and it's a book about the Haitian Revolution. It was published in 1938. And in those days, not a lot of people knew about the Haitian Revolution outside the Caribbean. And James's book actually wasn't picked up so much until a few decades later in the 60s, when it really began to circulate. So he was writing in 1938, that is, just on the eve of the Second World War. And in the preface to the book, he said this: tranquility today is either innate, the Philistine, or to be acquired only by a deliberate doping of the personality. It was in the stillness of a seaside suburb that could be heard most clearly and insistently the bombing of Franco's heavy artillery, the rattle of Stalin's firing squads, and the fierce, shrill turmoil of the revolutionary movement striving for clarity and influence. And so it's interesting. He says, basically, in 1938, there's no way you can be tranquil. You're either a Philistine, which I think he means to say is someone who's just naturally insensitive and has no interest in the world, or there's some deliberate doping of the personality going on. And to be in a quiet seaside suburb does not mean that one is separate from all of the turmoil in the world. In fact, in that quietness, one can hear even more clearly the crimes of fascism, the crimes of Soviet communism, as well as the movements gathering to try to transform the world. So, but this point about the doping of the personality is one that really stayed with me. And so I wanted to pose that for us. Are there ways in which you find you doping yourself? How do we dope ourselves? I think there are obvious ways, literal ways, like drugs and alcohol. But there are a lot of other ways if we start to think about it. In fact, I think that whenever we create a world or a bubble out of our thoughts that separates us from what's really going on, in a sense, we're doping ourselves. And we do that in so many different ways, right? But with all the agitation in the world, I think one of the ways we do it is through who we talk to and what we listen to and what we read and pay attention to. And so we can construct that bubble that we where we feel comfortable. It might be a bubble that we construct out of our left-wing blogs and listservs, or the liberal New York Times, or the right-wing Fox News. We can construct it out of Twitter and Facebook. But as Zen students, I wanted to really have us examine the question of whether we dope ourselves with our spiritual practice and our meditation practice. Now, I think that most of us come to spiritual practice because we're looking for some relief or some remedy from the suffering in our lives. Right? And If we're lucky, we find a kind of practice that is that helps us to do that. Maybe meditation, it may be the teachings, it may be a community that supports us. And we're fortunate if we have that. But I think we still also have to look at whether we use our practice in some way as an escape from reality. To not face what's going on around us. So there's a story, an old story, about a monk who was crossing the China Sea, and a storm picked up, and the boat was being tossed around from side to side, and all the people on the boat were getting sick, and they were crying out and scared, witless. And what did the monk do? He began reciting a sutra. And he recited it with so much concentration and intensity that he entered into an ecstatic state of bliss. And the commentary on this story is that monk was a total scoundrel because he was unable to actually accompany the people who were suffering all around him. So that's an example of kind of escapism that I think is really not what we're striving for in our practice. There are other models that we have to work with these kinds of conditions for facing the strife and the struggle and the suffering in our lives. So we have the example of the spirit of compassion, the manifestation of compassion, Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit, Kuan Yin in Chinese, Kanzeon or Kanon in Japanese. And as many of you know, but the name Avalokiteshvara means the one who hears the cries of the world, or the one who sees the suffering in the world. So the senses are open, the eyes are open, the ears are open, and Avalokiteshvara is contemplating it and taking it in, absorbing it, and Avalokiteshvara is then going to respond using the tools and resources at her disposal, right? I see this, I see the difficulty, the agitation, the anxiety, the sense of getting overwhelmed in myself, and I see it in people around me, and I see it in the people I talk to and interview in the Sangha. So this is a key problem for us now. I think, at this time of the month, we would normally be having a Fusatsu ceremony, an atonement ceremony. And in that, we would look at one of the precepts. And the precept that I've been talking about tonight is the fifth grave precept. The fifth grave precept, as I understand it, originally meant don't sell alcohol in the monastery. And by extension, don't consume alcohol in the monastery because it's not good for the community. So then we translate that in a broader sense as not intoxicating the mind. Or more broadly, not clouding the mind. And what I've been talking about tonight is not doping the mind, right? So when I'm the fifth grade precept has also been discussed by different teachers over time. So we have, for example, the old Chinese ancestor Bodhidharma had this to say about this precept. Self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma, not giving rise to delusions is called the precept of not giving or taking drugs. And then the great Japanese teacher Dogen said, drugs are not brought in yet. Don't let them invade. That is the great light. So both the Bodhidharma and Dogen are talking about a natural state available to all of us, which is not one of delusion. One in which our thoughts have not taken over our relationship to reality. And then the other interpretation that we have, that we work with, is the contemporary one from the Zen Peacemaker Order, which says, cultivating a mind that sees clearly. This is the precept of not being ignorant. Cultivating a mind that sees clearly. And I think this is exactly the mind of Avalokiteshvara. And is that something you can relate to in your own practice? I find that when I'm doing meditation these days, it's very rare for me to feel some state of ecstatic bliss. My eyes are not rolling back in my head. I'm just trying to keep my eyes open and see what's in front of me. And what's in front of me is usually not tranquility. What's in front of me is my mind flitting about, my agitation, stiffness in my back, or a pain in my legs. And I think this is really, really where it's at for us. I think that ultimately we're pursuing a pipe dream in thinking that what this practice is going to do is to get us to some state of tranquility in the midst of an untranquil world. I don't really think that's what this is about. I think that what we really need to try to do is just to stay present, as hard as it is. You know, we're on the edge of our practice, means we're constantly at risk of getting lost in our thoughts and getting overwhelmed by what we think is going on in the world. And so we have to find the balance for ourselves. No one knows what that balance is. We ourselves have to find it. We have our practice and our meditation as a way to find some respite and some refuge, but without it being a kind of escapism or denial. Right? And so I think that really we are doing the practice if we can just stay present, come back to what's really happening right now. Even with all of the sense of insecurity, uncertainty, instability, and lack of tranquility. If we can stay present and awake in the midst of that, I think that we can think of that as true stability and true security and true tranquility. I started with C.L.R. James, so I think I'll end with James Baldwin, who seems like the most the clearest voice for us all these days. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. Thank you for listening to me tonight. Good luck with your practice.